definitely demanded a requirement for states to prove their sincerity by changing their constitutions to perpetuate emancipation. This legitimate objection had the felicitous effect of allowing Chase to stay in front of Lincoln on Reconstruction in order to cement his standing in radical circles. While Republicans of all stripes praised the message, Chase expressed disappointment. Writing to the abolitionist Henry Ward Beecher, he said he had tried but failed to get Lincoln to make it more positive and less qualified. "But I suppose I must use Touchstone's philosophy and be thankful for skim milk when cream is not to be had." Lincoln approached the Christmas season in high spirits. As he said in his annual message, he detected a more hopeful mood in the country after the dark and doubtful days following the Emancipation Proclamation. The fall elections had been highly encouraging. The rebels had been defeated in a series of recent battles, and the opening round in the debate over Reconstruction had gone surprisingly well. Early in December, Lincoln translated his rhetoric about forgiveness and reconciliation into action when he invited his sister-in-law, Emily Helm, to stay at the White House. Emily's husband, Ben, had disappointed Lincoln in the early days of the war by taking a commission in the Confederate Army instead of Lincoln's offer of the Union Army paymaster's position. Helm was fatally wounded in Tennessee at the Battle of Chickamauga, where he commanded the 1st Kentucky Brigade. Judge Davis saw Lincoln shortly after he received the news of Helm's death. "I never saw Mr. Lincoln more moved than when he heard that his young brother-in-law, Ben Hardin Helm, scarcely 32 years of age, had been killed," Davis said. "I saw how grief-stricken he was, so I closed the door and left him alone." Emily had been living with her young daughter in Selma, Alabama, when she learned that her wounded husband had been taken to Atlanta. She reached the hospital minutes too late. Alone in Atlanta, she had no desire to return to Selma, where she had moved only for its proximity to her husband's post. Now she desperately wanted to see her mother in Kentucky. Confederate General Braxton Bragg unsuccessfully sought, through Grant, to secure a pass for her through Union lines. Helm's father then wrote to Betsy Todd, Mary's stepmother in Lexington, Kentucky, "I am totally at a loss to know how to begin. Could you or one of your daughters write to Mrs. Lincoln and, through her, secure a pass?" 4 days later, Lincoln personally issued a pass allowing Mrs. Todd to go south and bring her daughter, with her children, north to Kentucky. When Emily arrived at Fort Monroe, however, the officials demanded that she take the oath of allegiance to the United States. Unable to contemplate such a momentous step so soon after her husband's death in the Confederate cause, she refused. The officials sent a telegram to the president explaining the dilemma. They received a prompt directive: "Send her to me." After weeks of uncertainty, the young widow was received at the White House by the President and First Lady with the warmest affection. The three of them, Emily wrote in her diary, were all too grief-stricken at first for speech. The Lincolns had lost Willie, Emily had lost her husband, and the two sisters had lost three brothers in the Confederate Army: Sam Todd at Shiloh, David Todd from wounds at Vicksburg, and little Alexander, Mary's favorite baby brother, at Baton Rouge. Families rent apart by the Civil War abounded in border states such as Missouri or Kentucky, the ancestral home of the Todds. The reality of brother fighting brother lent an intimate horror to the idea of a nation divided. Often the boundaries separating people of opposing loyalties, the historian John Schaffer writes, were nothing more than the property line between two farms, or a table over which members of the same family argued and ultimately chose sides. That night, As Mary and Emily dined alone, they carefully avoided mention of the war, which comes between us, Emily acknowledged, like a barrier of granite closing our lips. They talked instead of old times and of old friends. Emily marveled at Mary's fine tact, which allowed her to so quickly turn a dangerous subject into other channels. In the days that followed, Mary did her utmost to deflect her sister's mind from her sorrow. She gave her the Prince of Wales guest room, took her for long carriage rides, made sure Emily's little daughter was entertained, and sat with her at night in the drawing-room before the light and warmth of a blazing fire. Emily's visit provided solace for both sisters. One night after Emily had gone to her room, Mary knocked on the door, intending to share an experience that she could not readily discuss with others. She wanted Emily to know that in her own grief over Willie's death, she now was comforted by the belief that his spirit was still present. "He comes to me every night," she told Emily, "with the same sweet, adorable smile he has always had. He does not always come alone. Little Eddie is sometimes with him, and twice he has come with our brother, Alec. He tells me he loves his uncle Alec, and is with him most of the time." The vision of spiritual harmony between Willie and Alec seemed to promise a day when the Todd family would again be united, and the devastating divisions between North and South would be dissolved by history. Then Mary herself would no longer be the scapegoat for both sides. "You cannot dream of the comfort this gives me," she told her sister, speaking with a thrill in her voice that Emily would long remember. Sadly for Mary, her reconciliation with her Confederate sister had some troubling consequences. Lincoln had tried to keep Emily's visit a secret, knowing that it would give rise to intense criticism at a time when Northerners were still punished for fraternizing with the enemy. On December 14th, he confided her presence to Browning, but cautioned that he did not wish it known. When two of Mary's friends, General Daniel Sickles and Senator Ira Harris, called on her one night, however, Mary let down her guard and invited Emily to join them. Both men were loyal to Lincoln and had been regulars at Mary's drawing-room salons. Lincoln had personally attended Sickles when Sickles returned to Washington after losing a leg at Gettysburg. Sickles had been in severe pain at the time, but Lincoln's cheerful presence at his bedside had helped to restore his spirits. Mary also considered Harris a special friend, recalling years later how he invariably brightened her drawing-room with his merriment. Still, neither Sickles nor Harris could tolerate the presence of a traitor in the home of the Commander-in-Chief. Emily recorded the events in her diary. No sooner had she entered the room than Senator Harris turned to her, a triumphant tone in his voice. "Well, we have whipped the rebels at Chattanooga, and I hear, madam, that the scoundrels ran like scared rabbits." Emily replied, "It was the example, Senator Harris, that you set them at Bull Run and Manassas." The conversation degenerated rapidly. Mary's face turned white as death when Senator Harris asked why Robert Lincoln had not joined the army. "If fault there be, it is mine," Mary replied. "I have insisted that he should stay in college a little longer." She did not state her underlying terror that she would lose another son.
"I have only one son, and he is fighting for his country," Harris countered.
"And, madam," he said, turning to Emily, "if I had 20 sons, they should all be fighting the rebels." "And if I had 20 sons," Emily coldly replied, "they should all be opposing yours." This brought the evening to an abrupt close. Emily fled the room with Mary close behind. The sisters threw their arms around each other and wept. The hot-tempered General Sickles insisted on reporting directly to Lincoln on what had happened. John Stewart, who was present, recalled that after Lincoln heard the tale, his eyes twinkled,
and he told the general, "The child has a tongue like the rest of the Todds." Lincoln's remark apparently infuriated Sickles, who said, in a loud, dictatorial voice, slapping the table with his hand, "You should not have that rebel in your house." "Excuse me, General Sickles," Lincoln replied. "My wife and I are in the habit of choosing our own guests. We do not need from our friends either advice or assistance in the matter." The nasty confrontation in the Red Room prompted Emily to leave, despite the protestations of Lincoln and Mary. "Oh, Emily," Mary lamented, "will we ever awake from this hideous nightmare?" Lincoln refused to let the unpleasant experience destroy his good humor. As Emily and Mary said their goodbyes, he took Nicolay and Hay to Ford's Theater to see James Hackett play Falstaff in Henry IV. Afterward, he engaged his aides in a lively conversation about the play. The next day, at the regular Tuesday cabinet meeting, Wells found him in fine spirits. Eager for distraction, Lincoln returned to Ford's Theater 2 days later for The Merry Wives of Windsor. The following evening, he was greeted with loud applause at Willard's Hall as he arrived for a lecture on Russia by the diplomat Bayard Taylor. The next week, Lincoln related a peculiarly pleasant dream. He was at a party, he told Hay, and overheard one of the guests say of him, "He is a very common-looking man." In the dream, he relished his reply, "The Lord prefers common-looking people. That is the reason he makes so many of them." His dreamed response still amused him as he recalled it the next day. The holiday season found most of the cabinet in cheerful spirits as well. Seward entertained the members of the visiting Russian fleet in his usual lavish style, a four-course meal served with an unlimited supply of the best wine. As the ladies took tea in the parlor, the men adjourned to the sitting room, where Fred Seward recalled that the conversation would often be continued for 2 or 3 hours in a cloud of smoke. Edward Bates, too, had reason to be gladdened, though he remained despondent over the defection of his son Fleming to the Confederate army. The rest of his large brood were doing well. Coulter had fought at Chancellorsville and Gettysburg, and remained on General Meade's staff. Woodson would soon graduate from West Point. Barton and Julian were both in Missouri, where Barton was a judge of the state Supreme Court, and Julian a surgeon in the Missouri militia. His two daughters lived with the family at home. Even Dick, his troubled eighth child, who had struggled with alcoholism, seemed to be improving. Of all the causes for holiday Thanksgiving, Bates was most grateful for his wife's complete return to health after her stroke. After 40 years of marriage, he still believed that no man has been more blessed. He was proud to make the rare claim that in all that time, Julia had never committed an unkind act toward him, nor spoken a disparaging word against him. On Christmas Day, he attended a funeral for the wife of one of his closest friends. The couple had been married for more than half a century. "I know not how he can bear the loss of such a companion," he wrote, speaking for himself as well as for his friend. "I am prepared to see him sink rapidly and die soon." Christmas Day found Wells rejoicing at his son Edgar's return from Kenyon College, though holiday festivities immediately brought back memories of the children he had lost. "The glad faces and loving childish voices that cheered our household with 'Merry Christmas' in years gone by are silent on earth forever." His mood was lightened, however, by the situation in the country. "The year closes more satisfactorily than it commenced," he wrote. "The heart of the nation is sounder, and its hopes brighter." Although the president still faced trying circumstances, Wells predicted that his leadership would be better appreciated in the future than now.
The Stantons' domestic life had brightened with the birth of a new baby girl, Bessie, 11 months after the death of their infant son, James. As Ellen prepared for the baptismal celebration, Stanton spent Christmas visiting wounded soldiers. He shared with the men his renewed faith that, "When the next anniversary of the day you are now celebrating occurs, this war will be ended, and you will have returned to your homes and your firesides. When you shall have so returned, you will be considered as honored guests of the nation." Lincoln invited Stanton to accompany him down the river to visit the Union prison camp at Point Lookout, Maryland. He had heard that a significant number of the rebel prisoners had expressed willingness to take the oath of allegiance to the United States and swear acceptance of emancipation in return for a full presidential pardon. The general in charge of the prison confirmed this hopeful intelligence when Lincoln and Stanton arrived, prompting Stanton to make plans for carrying Lincoln's 10% plan into the Deep South, where it might spur further disaffection in Confederate strongholds. As 1863 drew to a close, even the carping Count Gorofsky had to admit that the Union's position had improved. "Oh, dying year, you will record that the American people increased its sacrifices in proportion to its dangers, that blood, time, and money were cheerfully thrown into the balance against treason, inside and outside, and brighter hopes dawn." The surly count remained unwilling to acknowledge the president's role in the improved situation, but other former critics revealed a new appreciation of Lincoln. Charles Francis Adams, the American minister to Britain, had been unimpressed by his first encounter with Lincoln in 1861, describing him as a tall, ill-favored man, with little grace of manner or polish of appearance. After several awkward meetings, the haughty Adams had concluded that Lincoln did not belong to the same sphere of civilization as the rest of official Washington. The first 6 months of the administration further confirmed this low estimation. Adams saw in Lincoln no heroic qualities whatsoever, and was convinced that he was not equal to the gravity of his position. But by the end of 1863, Adams had drastically altered his assessment. At a festive dinner for loyal Americans in St. James's Hall in London, Adams delivered an eloquent speech praising Lincoln's leadership. He reminded his listeners of the dire situation the new president had faced arriving in Washington when the edifice of government seemed crumbling around him. Treachery reigned in every department. Traitors at Treasury had undermined the country's credit. The Foreign Service was replete with secessionists, and both the Army and the Navy had to be completely rebuilt. Few believed that this novice, who came to his post with less of practical experience in the government than any individual, was equal to the task. Nevertheless, the past 3 years had seen treason excised from government. European nations had come to look upon the North with respect. The Treasury was flush with funds to support the armed forces. The Army had grown to 500,000 men, and the Navy was now respected upon every sea in all parts of the globe. All this had been accomplished, Adams acknowledged with a remnant tinge of condescension, not because Lincoln possessed any superior genius, but because he, from the beginning to the end, impressed upon the people the conviction of his honesty and fidelity to one great purpose. James Russell Lowell, a Harvard professor considered the foremost American man of letters in his time, revealed a more incisive view of Lincoln's qualities. In a long article for the North American Review, which Lincoln read with pleasure, Lowell traced the progress of the Lincoln administration. "Never did a president enter upon office with less means at his command," he began. "All that was known of him was that he was a good stump speaker, nominated for his availability, that is, because he had no history." For many months, Lowell observed,
The untried president seemed too hesitant on military engagements, on emancipation, on recruiting black troops. Increasingly, it was becoming evident that this Abraham Lincoln was a character of marked individuality and capacity for affairs. In a democratic nation, Lowell added, where the rough-and-ready understanding of the people is sure at last to be the controlling power, a profound common sense is the best genius for statesmanship. Lincoln had demonstrated a perfectly calibrated touch for public sentiment and impeccable timing in his introduction of new measures. While some thought he had delayed his decision on emancipation too long, he undoubtedly had a sure-footed understanding of the American people. Similarly, when the first black regiments were formed, many feared that something terrible would happen, but the earth stood firm. Mr. Lincoln's perilous task has been to carry a rather shackly raft through the rapids, making fast the unrulier logs as he could snatch opportunity, concluded Lowell, and the country is to be congratulated that he did not think it his duty to run straight at all hazards, but cautiously to assure himself with his setting pole where the main current was, and keep steadily to that. Despite the remarkable transformations of the previous 3 years, Lowell understood that the raft was still in wild water. So, of course, did Lincoln. The president recommended the Lowell piece to Gideon Welles, telling him it presented a very excellent discussion of the administration's policy, but that it gave him overmuch credit. Chapter 23. There's a Man in It. New Year's Day, 1864, dawned fearfully cold and windy, Noah Brooks recorded, and the morning newspaper and the milkman were alike snapped up by the nipping frosts. Eventually a bright sun scattered the clouds, and a mood of good cheer enveloped the city as the National Republican headlined the long list of Union victories during the previous year. Murfreesboro, Vicksburg, Morris Island, Gettysburg, Port Hudson, Chattanooga, Knoxville. History does not furnish a year's victories by the armies of any country in any war that will excel these, the National Republican boasted. We have a right to be somewhat gay and festive here at the National Metropolis. No one wishes to deny that we have had a rebellious storm, and that the political horizon is still somewhat muggy. But our gallant old ship of state, with Abraham Lincoln at the helm, has weathered the gale. William Stoddard echoed these sentiments in a published dispatch. The instinct of all, rather than the reasoning, teaches us, as it has the rest of the country, that once and for all the danger is over. At 10 a.m., official Washington began arriving at the White House for the traditional New Year's reception. At noon, when the gates opened to the general public, 8,000 people streamed in. A human kaleidoscope, constantly changing, of diplomats and dragoons, exquisites from the Atlantic cities, and hardy backwoodsmen, contented contractors and shoddy swindlers, ingenious patentees and persevering petitioners. Lincoln considered his meeting with the general public his public opinion baths. They serve to renew in me a clearer and more vivid image of that great popular assemblage out of which I sprung, he told a visitor. And though they may not be pleasant in all their particulars, the effect, as a whole, is renovating and invigorating to my perceptions of responsibility and duty. European Democrats go into ecstasies over so palpable a sign of our universal equality, Stoddard noted, while European aristocrats, attachés of legations, tourists, and the like, turn up their noses somewhat scornfully at so singularly American a custom. Visitors noted that Lincoln appear to be in excellent health and spirits, and whatever perplexities his generals may give him, he possesses the happy faculty of leaving them in his office upstairs when he comes down to receive the salutations of the people. His clear eyes beamed with good humor, and he not only cordially returned the pressure of each offered hand, but generally said a pleasant word or two. Noah Brooks noted that Mary Lincoln never looked better, having replaced her black mourning garb with a rich purple velvet dress. "We seem to have reached a new stage in the war," Fred Seward wrote home. "Gaiety has become as epidemic in Washington this winter as gloom was last winter. There is a lull in political discussions. The people are inclined to eat, drink, and be merry. The newspapers can furnish nothing more interesting to their readers than accounts of parties, balls, and theaters, like so many court journals. Questions of etiquette are debated with gravity. People talk of society who never before knew or cared about it." The winter social calendar followed a prescribed order. The president's receptions were on Tuesday evenings, the first lady's matinees on Saturday afternoons, the soirees of the Speaker of the House on Friday nights. No cards of invitation were required for these events. Since the president and speaker held their offices at the will of the people, their homes were open to the public at large. In contrast, invitations were necessary and highly coveted for the elegant parties at the dwellings of cabinet officers. Access to the drawing rooms of Seward and Chase were prized most of all. Social columnists attributed the legendary success of the parties held by the Secretary of State to both his genial wit and the grace and elegance of his daughter-in-law Anna, who, with such rare art, groups those of congenial tastes and makes all truly at home. For young belles, there was added mystique in the presence of the diplomatic corps, which held out the titillating prospect of attracting a titled foreigner. For those fascinated by fashion and etiquette, nothing compared to the impeccable manners and gorgeous dress of the diplomats, bespangled with ribbons and garters denoting different orders of knighthood. "Who wonders that the house of Governor Seward is a favorite resort?" one columnist asked. "And who that enjoys his hospitality does not wish that he might be Secretary of State forever and be at home once a week?" At the Chase Mansion, Kate Sprague continued to be the observed of all observers. Whether dressed in blue brocade, gray, or simple black, she impressed congressmen, senators, and generals alike with her interest in politics and familiarity with military affairs. Holding court at the entrance, she had an appropriate greeting for every guest. Benjamin French thought her one of the most lovable women he had ever seen. Noah Brooks was likewise smitten, at once recognizing the delightful contrast to her frosty father, who looked uncomfortable and generally bothered at these affairs. Chase's nearsightedness had grown so extreme that he was unable to recognize anyone without a very close examination. Nevertheless, he still refused to wear glasses. The Washington elite preferred the fancy dinner parties at the Seward and Chase mansions to the public levees at the White House, where bonnets were crushed and cloaks occasionally stolen in the chaos. During the winter, Mary found it necessary to put durable brown coverings over her elegant French carpets to protect them from the muddy tramp of the human tide that poured in to shake hands with the president. Many visitors were ill-dressed and bedraggled, as after a long, dusty ride, and some still carried their carpet bags. The elegant furnishings that Mary had so lovingly and expensively put in place took a beating. Brooks noted that the lace curtains, heavy cords, tassels, and damask drapery have suffered considerably this season from the hands of relic-hunting vandals who actually clip off small bits of the precious stuff to carry home as mementos. Desperate to preserve their experience, some even lifted the brown covering and cut out pieces of the French carpet as large as a man's hand. For Mary, who relished her position as First Lady, it was galling to read in the papers that Seward, not she, would inaugurate the fashionable season. He was to host an exclusive party for the visiting members of the National Academy of Science, along with the heads of the foreign legations, the cabinet, the justices of the Supreme Court, the presiding officers of the two houses of Congress, and the committees on foreign relations, with their families. That same week, the New York Herald noted, the White House reception was not so largely attended as usual. Benjamin French, who was Mary's customary escort at public functions, saw that she was disappointed. The Sewards hosted three more receptions in January 1864, accounted the grandest, most elegant, and most brilliant affairs of the season, with guest lists including barons, counts, lords, ladies, and young Robert Lincoln, home for vacation. Mary's wounded pride increased her feelings of resentment toward Seward. She continued to begrudge the intimacy he shared with her husband, the many nights Lincoln chose to spend with Seward instead of her. Fred Seward records a pleasant evening that January when Lincoln walked over to Seward's with John Hay to share a humorous language guidebook, English as She Is Spoke. As John Hay read aloud its queer inverted sentences, Lincoln and Seward laughed heartily, their minds finding a brief but welcome relief from care. Though Seward had long since ceased to be a political threat to her husband, Mary could not relinquish her suspicions. She told their family friend, Anson Henry, that Seward and his friends were behind the various scandalous reports in circulation about her. Dr. Henry dismissed her fears, saying that the nasty rumors probably originated in the Treasury Department, for he had traced many of them to Chase's friends and supporters. Indeed, by early 1864, Chase's presidential ambitions were widely known and frequently discussed in political circles. Mary's anger toward Chase grew very bitter, Elizabeth Keckley recalled. She warned Mr. Lincoln not to trust him. But Lincoln continued to insist that Chase was a patriot. As Mary planned for her first state dinner of the year, traditionally held for the members of the cabinet, justices of the Supreme Court, and their families, she decided to take matters into her own hands. She perused the guest list compiled by John Nicolay and crossed out the names of Kate Chase and William Sprague. Certain the snub would become public and reflect badly on Lincoln, Nicolay appealed to his boss to reinstate the Spragues. Lincoln immediately agreed, sending Mary into a rage. "There soon arose such a rampage as the house hasn't seen for a year," Nicolay confided to an absent Hay, "and I am again taboo. How the thing is to end is yet as dark a problem as the Schleswig-Holstein difficulty." Mary directed her wrath toward Nicolay, banishing him from the dinner and eschewing his customary help with the arrangements. "Things ran on thus till the afternoon of the dinner," Nicolay reported, "when Mary backed down, requested my presence and assistance, apologizing and explaining that the affair had worried her so she hadn't slept for a night or two." The dinner was pleasant, Wells recorded in his diary. "A little stiff and awkward on the part of some of the guests," perhaps referring to Chase, "but passed off very well." Wells, however, was unable to share the capital's renewed delight in parties, receptions, and fairs. It all seemed inappropriate, "like merrymaking at a funeral," he wrote his son Edgar. Not every occasion was merely a frivolous distraction. The hosts and partygoers did not forget the imperiled men in the armed forces. Where once the old secession or semi-secesh element reigned in Washington society, injured soldiers and sailors became the stars of every occasion. Admiral Dahlgren's 21-year-old son, Ulrich, had lost a leg at Gettysburg. When he appeared at a Washington party, he was surrounded by pretty girls. They stayed by his side all night, refusing to dance, in tribute to the handsome colonel who had been known as an expert waltzer. In late January, Copperhead Congressman Fernando Wood of New York, who had often and bitterly denounced the Republican administration and the war, threw a great party to which he invited Republicans as well as fellow Democrats. Republicans were expected to stay away, but many actually attended, as did abolitionists of the most ultra stripe. Stoddard found it one of the charming features of life in Washington that political animosities were not carried into social life, that people who publicly savaged one another could still be commendably cordial and friendly in all personal intercourse. In keeping with that tradition, Mary Lincoln sent a bouquet of flowers to Mrs. Wood. The Woods exaggerated the courtesy by placing cards that read, "Compliments of Mrs. A. Lincoln," beside all the many flower vases, making it appear that Mary had supplied the entire array. Newspapers played up the story, citing the supposedly lavish display as evidence of Mary's Southern sympathies. Stung by the criticism, Mary wrote her influential friend General Sickles, "I am pleased to announce to you my entire innocence. With the exception of two political public receptions, they, the Woods, have not entered the White House. All of my friends, who know my detestation of disloyal persons, will discredit the rumor. You know me too well to believe it." Still, slander against the President and First Lady continued to fill the columns of opposition papers. In December, when Emily Todd Helm had come through Union lines after her husband's death, she had been accompanied north by another sister, Martha Todd White. After Emily left the White House, Lincoln issued a pass to Martha, allowing her to return to the Confederacy. Such passes were not unusual, but the false story spread that Lincoln, presumably at his wife's request, had granted a special permit allowing Martha to bring her bags through without inspection. Some opposition papers claimed that she was in fact a Confederate spy, and had used her privilege to smuggle contraband through Union lines. It was bruited that when she arrived at Fort Monroe and was told to open her trunks, she waved the President's permit in General Butler's face, defiantly proclaiming, "Here," pushing it under their noses, "is the positive order of your master." Ordinarily, Lincoln took little heed of scurrilous rumors, but in this case he directed Nicolay to ascertain the facts from General Butler. Butler replied that the smuggling story was spurious. Mrs. White's bags had undergone the usual search. Nothing untoward had been found. Nicolay used Butler's letter to document a public rebuttal of the fraudulent story. Butler was surprised that the White House would even bother to respond to something so silly. But after the Wood affair had cast doubt on his wife's loyalty, Lincoln may have wanted to nip the new round of rumors in the bud. Nor did he want his soldiers to think that he would ever facilitate the Confederates' access to contraband items that might sustain the rebel cause. It is scarcely surprising that Lincoln, not long afterward, showed little patience when his old friend Orville Browning requested a favor for a loyal Unionist who owned a cotton plantation in Mississippi. When the Union Army overran her home and took her slaves, she had fallen into poverty. She asked if the government could provide her an equal number of Negroes whom she would pay to work her farm. Lincoln became very much excited, according to Browning, and said with great vehemence he had rather take a rope and hang himself than to do it. When Browning argued for some sort of remuneration for the lost property, Lincoln countered that she had lost no property, that her slaves were free when they were taken. Puzzled by Lincoln's sharp reaction, Browning left him in no very good humor. As was usually the case with Lincoln's rare episodes of pique, other strains had contributed to the sharp rejoinder. Earlier that day he had visited the sickbed of Illinois Congressman Owen Lovejoy, whom he considered the best friend he had in Congress. The 53-year-old Lovejoy was suffering from a debilitating liver and kidney ailment that would soon take his life. Lincoln was distraught over Lovejoy's misery and seemed to internalize the grim prospects facing his friend. "This war is eating my life out," he told the dying Lovejoy. "I have a strong impression that I shall not live to see the end." On the night of February 10th, a fire alarm rang in the White House. Smoke was seen issuing from the president's private stables, which stood between the mansion and the Treasury building, and Lincoln raced to the scene. When he reached the boxwood hedge that served as an enclosure to the stables, a member of his bodyguard, Robert McBride, recalled, he sprang over it like a deer. Learning that the horses were still inside, Lincoln, with his own hands, burst open the stable door. It was immediately apparent that the fast-moving fire, the work of an arsonist, prevented any hope of rescue. Notwithstanding this, McBride observed, he would apparently have tried to enter the burning building had not those standing near caught and restrained him. 6 horses burned to death that night. When McBride returned to the White House, he found Lincoln in tears. 10-year-old Tad explained his father's emotion. One of the ponies had belonged to his brother, Willie. A coachman who had been fired by Mary that morning was charged with setting the fire. The following day, Lincoln had collected himself and moved forward. He called Commissioner French to his office and instructed him to consult contractors, estimate the cost, and bring the matter to the attention of Congress today, if possible, that measures might be taken to have it rebuilt. Lincoln's gift for managing men was never more apparent than during the presidential boomlet for Chase that peaked in the winter months of 1864. While Chase's supporters prematurely showed their hand, Lincoln, according to the Pennsylvania politician Alexander McClure, carefully veiled his keen and sometimes bitter resentment against Chase and waited the fullness of time when he could, by some fortuitous circumstance, remove Chase as a competitor, or by some shrewd manipulation of politics, make him a hopeless one. The game had begun in earnest early in January. Friends of Chase, including Jay and Henry Cook, contributed thousands of dollars to the publisher of the American Exchange and Review, a small Philadelphia magazine, so he would print a flattering biographical sketch of the Treasury Secretary. Chase's friend William Orton warned him that, no matter how able or faithful the biography may be, its publication in a seedy magazine, with a reputation for selling its space to whomever could pay enough, would be seen as a flimsy political trick. Orton's note elicited no direct reply, but at some point the president had apparently questioned the involvement of the Cook brothers, who were still official agents for selling government bonds. The president's questions elicited a long, emotional letter from Chase. Chase opened his letter with the assertion that his actions, as always, proceeded from the purest of motives. He claimed that he had never, consciously and deliberately, injured one fellow man. He had been told that the publisher intended to print a series of sketches about prominent figures, starting with him. How could I object? Treasury business so occupied him that he had paid no further attention to the matter. What Mr. H.D. Cook did about the unfortunate biography was done of his own accord, without any prompting from me, Chase insisted. Had Cook or his brother sought his consent, he would have stopped them. Not that any wrong was intended or done, but because the act was subject to misconstruction. You will pardon me if I write as one somewhat moved. It makes me hate public life when I realize how powerless are the most faithful labors and the most upright conduct to protect any man from carping envy or malignant denunciations. Embarrassment over the circumstances surrounding the Exchange and Review piece did not stop Chase from writing 25 long letters that winter to the Boston writer John Trowbridge. His missives were designed to provide the foundation for a small inspirational book about his life, The Ferry Boy and the Financier. An excerpt appeared that spring in the Atlantic Monthly. These letters were but a small part of a massive campaign to extol his own virtues at Lincoln's expense. From early morning until late at night, Chase toiled to maintain his stream of correspondence with friends and supporters. "So far," he told a friend in Cincinnati, "I think I have made few mistakes. Indeed, on looking back over the whole ground with an earnest desire to detect error and correct it, I am not able to see where, if I had to do my work all over again, I could in any matter do materially otherwise than I have." With Kate married and Nettie away at school, Chase resumed his sporadic correspondence with Charlotte Eastman. "I think of you constantly," he assured her, "and, if any feeling is left in me, with the sincerest affection. How I wish you were here in our house, in this little library room, and that we could talk, instead of this writing by myself, while you are... where?" Such romantic inclinations were probably never consummated. Similarly, though he enjoyed the company of Susan Walker, an educated blue stocking from Cincinnati, the relationship never seemed to deepen. "I wish you could come to Washington," he wrote Miss Walker in late January, "though I could probably see so little of you that it would be difficult to tell which would be greater, the pleasure of seeing you, or the sensation of not seeing you enough." Though Chase obviously admired both Eastman and Walker, his intense focus on his ambition for the presidency kept him from ever making the time to unbend in their company. The second push in Chase's race for the presidential nomination opened with the public announcement of a Chase for President committee. The committee, headed by Kansas Senator Samuel Pomeroy and a successful railroad agent, James Winchell, was another enterprise backed by Jay Cook. In this case, however, Chase's son-in-law, William Sprague, contributed the largest share of the funds. Pomeroy and Winchell were both committed abolitionists who believed Chase would best protect the rights of blacks. Their appearance of altruistic principle was compromised by the fact that they stood to benefit financially if Chase released funds for the construction of the Kansas Pacific Railroad, in which both held a large interest. Lincoln's old friend, Judge David Davis, was incensed that Chase was eating a man's bread and stabbing him at the same time. Chase, unsurprisingly, viewed things differently. Since one-term presidencies had become the rule, Chase felt justified in presenting himself as an alternative. While the committee was being organized, Chase busied himself lining up support in Ohio, determined to avoid the humiliation he had suffered in 1860 when his own state had withheld its support. Optimistic that he might defeat Lincoln, Chase told his old law partner, Flamen Ball, that he was immensely gratified by the newly formed committee and the quality of the people supporting his candidacy, for they tended to be men of great weight. Much would depend on the Buckeye State, for if Ohio should express a preference for any other person, I would not allow my name to be used. Should all go well, Chase believed he would put up a good fight against the president. For, sad to say, the prairie lawyer was simply not up to the job. If, to his kindliness of spirit and good sense, he joined strong will and energetic action, there would be little left to wish for in him. As it is, I think that he will be likely to close his first term with more honor than he will the second, should he be reelected. Nor did Chase confine his criticisms of Lincoln to conversation and correspondence with trusted friends. Speaking with Gideon Wells early in February, he lamented the want of energy and force by the president, which he said paralyzed everything. Disregarding Wells's silence, he went on to suggest that the president's weakness was crushing the nation. When Wells still did not respond to this distinct feeler, Chase finally let the matter drop. Chase was equally indiscreet with Bates, seeming not to recognize that while the Attorney General occasionally criticized the president, he immeasurably preferred him to any other candidate. Lincoln seemed unfazed by the machinations surrounding the race. Wells reported with delight an exchange with a fair, plump lady who appeared in the hallway just before a cabinet meeting. She said she lived in Iowa and had come to get a look at the president. Hearing her story, Lincoln invited her into his office. "Well, in the matter of looking at one another," said he with a smile and a chuckle, "I have altogether the advantage." In February, the Pomeroy Committee distributed a confidential circular to 100 leading Republicans throughout the North. Intended to mobilize support for Chase, the circular opened with a slashing critique of the president, claiming that, "even with a re-election of Mr. Lincoln desirable, it is practically impossible, given the widespread opposition. Furthermore, should he be re-elected, his manifest tendency toward compromises and temporary expedience of policy will become stronger during a second term than it has been in the first. The war would continue to languish, the country would be bankrupted, and the dignity of the nation would suffer. Therefore, in order to win the war, establish the peace, and vindicate the honor of the Republic, it was essential that Republicans unite in nominating the one man with more of the qualities needed in a president during the next 4 years than are combined in any other available candidate. Salmon P. Chase." When the Pomeroy Circular was leaked to the press, it created a political explosion. Lincoln's friends were furious, while Democrats celebrated the open division in Republican ranks. "No sensible man here is in doubt that Chase was privy to this," David Davis told a friend. "They did not expect that it would see the light so soon. I would dismiss him from the cabinet if it killed me." In a state of panic, Chase sent Lincoln a letter in which he claimed he had no knowledge of the circular until it was printed in the Constitutional Union on February 20th. Though he had been approached by friends to use his name in the coming election, he had not been consulted about the formation of the Pomeroy Committee and was unfamiliar with its members. "You are not responsible for acts not your own," he reminded Lincoln, "nor will you hold me responsible except for what I do or say myself." Yet he proclaimed, "If there is anything in my action or position which, in your judgment, will prejudice the public interest under my charge, I beg you to say so. I do not wish to administer the Treasury Department one day without your entire confidence." It is unlikely that Lincoln believed Chase's protestations of innocence. Indeed, a decade later, the circular's author, James Winchell, testified that Chase had been fully informed about everything and had personally affirmed that the arraignment of the administration made in the circular was one which he thoroughly endorsed and would sustain. Still, Lincoln restrained his anger and carefully gauged his response, taking a dispassionate view of the situation. He understood the political landscape, he assured Bates. There was a number of malcontents within his own party who would strike him at once if they durst, but they fear that the blow would be ineffectual, and so they would fall under his power as beaten enemies. So long as he remained confident that he had the public's support, he could afford to let the game play out a little longer. Keeping Chase in suspense, Lincoln simply acknowledged receipt of the letter and promised to answer a little more fully when I can find time to do so. Then he sat back to measure the reaction of the people to the circular. It did not take long. The morning it was printed, Wells correctly predicted, "Its recoil will be more dangerous, I apprehend, than its projectile. That is, it will damage Chase more than Lincoln." Even papers friendly to Chase lamented the circular's publication. "It is unworthy of the cause," the New York Times proclaimed. "We protest against the spirit of this movement." 4 days later, Nicolay happily informed his fiancée, Serena, that the effect of the circular had been the opposite of what its authors intended. For, it has stirred up all Mr. Lincoln's friends to active exertion, seriously diminishing Chase's prospects. In state after state, Republicans met and passed unanimous resolutions in favor of Lincoln's renomination. Even in Pomeroy's home state of Kansas, a counter-circular was distributed among Republicans that denounced the efforts to carry the state for Chase and rallied support for Lincoln. Noting the long list of state legislatures that had come out for Lincoln, the Times acknowledged that the universality of popular sentiment in favor of Mr. Lincoln's re-election is one of the most remarkable developments of the time. The faith of the people in the sound judgment and honest purpose of Mr. Lincoln is as tenacious as if it were a veritable instinct. Nothing can overcome it or seriously weaken it. This power of attracting and holding popular confidence springs only from a rare combination of qualities. Very few public men in American history have possessed it in an equal degree with Abraham Lincoln. Harper's Weekly agreed. In an editorial endorsing the president's re-election, it claimed that, among all the prominent men in our history, from the beginning, none have ever shown the power of understanding the popular mind so accurately as Mr. Lincoln. In moving gradually toward emancipation, as he had done, the Harper's editor observed, Lincoln understood that in a democracy, every step he took must seem wise to the great public mind. Thus, he had wisely nullified the premature proclamations issued by Fremont and Hunter, waiting until the blood of sons and brothers and friends would wash clear 1,000 eyes that had been blinded. In his grudging fashion, even Lincoln's critic, Count Gorofsky, acknowledged the president's hold on the people's affections. The masses are taken in by Lincoln's apparent simplicity and good-naturedness, by his awkwardness, by his vulgar jokes, and in the people's belief, the great shifter is earnest and honest. The fatal blow to the Chase campaign came again in Ohio, as it had 4 years before. Although Chase's friends in the Union Caucus of the state legislature had previously blocked attempts to endorse Lincoln's re-election, the publication of the Pomeroy Circular, a Chase ally conceded, brought matters to a crisis. It arrayed at once men against each other who had been party friends always, and finally produced a perfect convulsion in the party. The end result was the unanimous passage of a resolution in favor of Lincoln. As matters now stand here, with so many states already declared for Lincoln, Chase's friend Cleveland attorney Richard Parsons warned, prolonging a contest that will, in the end, array our house against itself and bring no good to our party at last, seems to me one of the gravest character. Perceiving this turn of events, Lincoln decided the time was right to answer Chase's letter. He informed Chase that the circular had not surprised him, for he had knowledge of Mr. Pomeroy's committee and of its secret issues and secret agents for a number of weeks. However, he did not intend to hold Chase responsible. "I fully concur with you that neither of us can be justly held responsible for what our respective friends may do without our instigation or countenance. And I assure you, as you have assured me, that no assault has been made upon you by my instigation or with my countenance." As to whether Chase should remain as Treasury Secretary, Lincoln would decide based solely on my judgment of the public service. For the present, he wrote, "I do not perceive occasion for a change." A few days later, Chase withdrew his presidential bid. In a public letter to an influential state senator in Ohio, he reminded his fellow Ohioans that he had determined to withdraw from the race if he did not gain the support of his home state. With the legislature's support of Lincoln, "it becomes my duty, therefore, and I count it more a privilege than a duty, to ask that no further consideration be given to my name." Trying, as ever, to explain his action as an unselfish move, Chase told his daughter Nettie that he had withdrawn from the race, "though a good many of the best and most earnest men of the country desired to make me a candidate, because it was becoming daily more and more clear that the continuance of my name before the people would produce serious discords in the union organization, and might endanger the success of the measures and the establishment of the principles I thought most indispensable to the welfare of the country." Attorney General Bates suggested a less patriotic explanation. "It proves only that the present prospects of Mr. Lincoln are too good to be openly resisted." Discipline and keen insight had once again served Lincoln most effectively. By regulating his emotions and resisting the impulse to strike back at Chase when the circular first became known, he gained time for his friends to mobilize the massive latent support for his candidacy. Chase's aspirations were crushed without Lincoln's direct intrusion. He had known all along that his Treasury Secretary was no innocent, but by seeming to accept Chase's word, he allowed the Secretary to retain some measure of his dignity while the country retained his services in the cabinet. Lincoln himself would determine the appropriate time for Chase's departure. Lincoln's ability to retain his emotional balance in such difficult situations was rooted in an acute self-awareness and an enormous capacity to dispel anxiety in constructive ways. In the most difficult moments of his presidency, nothing provided Lincoln greater respite and renewal than to immerse himself in a play at either Grover's or Ford's. Leonard Grover estimated that Lincoln had visited his theater more than 100 times during his 4 years as president. He was most frequently accompanied by Seward, who shared Lincoln's passion for drama and was an old friend of Mr. Grover's. But his 3 young assistants, Nicolay, Hay, and Stoddard, also joined him on occasion, as did Noah Brooks, Mary, and Tad. On many nights, Lincoln came by himself, delighted at the chance to sink into his seat as the gas lights dimmed and the action on the stage began. "It gave him an hour or two of freedom from care and worry," observed Brooks. "And, what was better, freedom from the interruption of office-seekers and politicians." He was on such terms with the managers of 2 of the theaters that he could go in privately by the stage door and slip into the stage boxes without being seen by the audience. More than anything else, Stoddard remarked how the drama, by drawing his mind into other channels of thought, afforded him the most entire relief. At a performance of Henry IV, Part I, Stoddard noted how thoroughly Lincoln enjoyed himself. "He has forgotten the war. He has forgotten Congress. He is out of politics. He is living in Prince Hal's time." It is not surprising that the theater offered ideal refreshment for a man who regularly employed storytelling to ease tensions. The theater held all the elements of a perfect escape. Enthralled by the live drama, the costumes and scenery, the stagecraft, and the rhetorical extravagances, he was transported into a realm far from the troubling events that filled the rest of his waking hours. In the mid-19th century, developments with gaslight had vastly improved the experience of theatergoers. Managers had learned to dim or brighten illumination by manipulating the valves that fed the gas to the jets. A setting sun, a full moon, or a misty evening could be achieved by placing colored glass mantles over the lamps. Technicians stationed above the balcony could illuminate individual actors as they made their entrance onto the stage. To envision 19th century theater audiences correctly, the cultural historian Lawrence Levine suggests, one might do well to visit a contemporary sporting event in which the spectators not only are similarly heterogeneous, but are also
more than an audience. They are participants who can enter into the action on the field, who feel a sense of immediacy, and at times even of control, who articulate their opinions and feelings vocally and unmistakably. Though different classes occupy different areas of the theater, the wealthy in the first tier boxes, the working class in the orchestra, and the poor in the balcony, the entire audience shared a fairly intimate space. Indeed, Frances Trollope complained that in American theaters she encountered men without jackets, their sleeves rolled to their elbows, and their breath smelling of onions and whiskey. Though Lincoln was seated in his presidential box, he could still enjoy the communal experience, which allowed him to feel the pulse of the people, much as he had done when he traveled the circuit in his early days. The years surrounding the Civil War have been called the Golden Age of American acting. During those years, one historian claims, the American theater was blessed with a galaxy of performers who have never been excelled, including Edwin Forrest, John McCullough, Edwin Booth, Laura Keene, and Charlotte Cushman. It was said of Miss Cushman, who was lionized in both Europe and America for her role as Lady Macbeth, that she was not a great actress merely, but she was a great woman. She had a magnetic personality, and when she came upon the stage, she filled it with the brilliant vitality of her presence. A liberated woman, far ahead of her time, she had lovers, but never married. Her work was her chief passion. Seward and Miss Cushman had met in the 1850s and become great friends. Whenever she was in Washington, she stayed at the Seward home. The celebrated actress forged a close relationship with young Fanny, who idolized her. Miss Cushman offered a glimpse of the vital and independent life Fanny hoped to lead someday, if her dream to become a writer came true. "Imagine me," Fanny wrote her mother after one of Miss Cushman's visits, "full of the old literary fervor and anxious to be at work, to try hard, and at the same time, learn to labor and to wait. I mean, improve in the work which I cannot choose but take. I am full of hope that I may yet make my life worth the living and be of some use in the world." In honor of the star guest, Seward organized a series of dinner parties, inviting members of foreign legations and cabinet colleagues. For her part, Miss Cushman regarded Seward as the greatest man this country ever produced. Fanny believed that Cushman understood her noble father better than almost anyone outside their family. Fred Seward recalled that Lincoln made his way to their house almost every night while Miss Cushman visited. Seward had introduced Cushman to the president in the summer of 1861. She had hoped to ask Lincoln for help in obtaining a West Point appointment for a young friend, but the scintillating conversation distracted her from the purpose of her visit. And Lincoln was undoubtedly riveted by the celebrated actress of his beloved Shakespeare. Unlike Seward, who had been attending theater since he was a young man, Lincoln had seen very few live performances until he came to Washington. So excited was he by his first sight of Falstaff on the stage that he wrote the actor James Hackett, "Perhaps the best compliment I can pay is to say, as I truly can, I am very anxious to see it again." Although he had not read all of Shakespeare's plays, he told Hackett that he had studied some of them, perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. Among the latter are Lear, Richard III, Henry VIII, Hamlet, and especially Macbeth. "I think nothing equals Macbeth. It is wonderful. Unlike you gentlemen of the profession, I think the soliloquy in Hamlet, commencing, 'Oh, my offense is rank,' surpasses that commencing, 'To be or not to be.' But pardon this small attempt at criticism." When Hackett shared the president's letter with friends, it unfortunately made its way into opposition newspapers. Lincoln was promptly ridiculed for his attempt to render dramatic judgments. An embarrassed Hackett apologized to Lincoln, who urged him to have no uneasiness on the subject. He was not shocked by the newspaper comments,
For all his life he had endured a great deal of ridicule without much malice. The histories and tragedies of Shakespeare that Lincoln loved most dealt with themes that would resonate to a president in the midst of a civil war. Political intrigue, the burdens of power, the nature of ambition, the relationship of leaders to those they governed. The plays illuminated with stark beauty the dire consequences of civil strife, the evils wrought by jealousy and disloyalty, the emotions evoked by the death of a child, the sundering of family ties, or love of country. Congressman William D. Kelly of Pennsylvania recalled bringing the actor John McDonough to the White House on a stormy night. Lincoln had relished McDonough's performance as Edgar in King Lear and was delighted to meet him. For his part, McDonough was an intensely partisan Democrat and had accepted the theory that Mr. Lincoln was a mere buffoon. His attitude changed after spending 4 hours discussing Shakespeare with the president. Lincoln was eager to know why certain scenes were left out of productions. He was fascinated by the different ways that classic lines could be delivered. He lifted his well-thumbed volume of Shakespeare from the shelf, reading aloud some passages, repeating others from memory. When the clock approached midnight, Kelly stood up to go, chagrined to have kept the president so long. Lincoln swiftly assured his guests that he had not enjoyed such a season of literary recreation in many months. The evening had provided an immensely pleasant interval from his work. Of all the remarkable stage actors in this golden time, none surpassed Edwin Booth, son of the celebrated tragedian Junius Booth, and elder brother to Lincoln's future assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Edwin Booth has done more for the stage in America than any other man, wrote a drama critic in the 1860s. The soulful young actor captivated audiences everywhere with the naturalness of his performances and his conversational tone, which stood in contrast to the bombastic, stylized performances of the older generation. In late February and early March 1864, Edwin Booth came to Grover's Theatre for a 3-week engagement, delivering one masterly performance after another. Lincoln and Seward attended the theatre night after night. They saw Booth in the title roles of Hamlet and Richard III. They applauded his performance as Brutus in Julius Caesar and as Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. On Friday evening, March 11th, Booth came to dinner at the Sewards. 20-year-old Fanny Seward could barely contain her excitement. She had seen every one of his performances and had been transfixed by his magnificent dark eyes. At dinner, Seward presumed to ask Booth if he might advise the thespian how his acting might be improved. According to Fanny, Booth accepted father's criticisms very gracefully, often saying he had felt those defects himself. Seward focused particularly on Booth's performance in Bulwer Lytton's Richelieu, where he thought he had made the crafty cardinal too old and infirm. Long identified as the power behind the throne himself, Seward perhaps wanted a younger, more vibrant characterization for Richelieu. When Seward told Booth he thought his performance as Shylock was perfect, Booth disagreed, saying he had a painful sense of something wanting, could compare it to nothing else but the want of body in wine. Detained at the White House, Lincoln missed the enjoyable interchange with Booth. A few days earlier, anticipating Booth's Hamlet, Lincoln had talked about the play with Francis Carpenter, the young artist who was at work on his picture depicting the first reading of the Emancipation Proclamation. In the course of the conversation, Lincoln recited from memory his favorite passage, the King's soliloquy after the murder of Hamlet's father, "with a feeling and appreciation unsurpassed by anything I ever witnessed upon the stage." What struck Carpenter most forcefully was Lincoln's ability to appreciate tragedy and comedy with equal intensity,
He could in one sitting bring tears to a visitor's eyes with a sensitive rendering from Richard III, and moments later induce riotous laughter with a comic tall tale. His laugh, Carpenter observes, stood by itself. The neigh of a wild horse on his native prairie is not more undisguised than hearty. Lincoln's ability to commingle joy with sorrow seemed to Carpenter a trait the president shared with his favorite playwright. It has been well said, Carpenter noted, that the spirit which held the woe of Lear and the tragedy of Hamlet would have broken had it not also had the humor of the Merry Wives of Windsor and the merriment of Midsummer Night's Dream. No other cabinet member went to the theater as regularly as Lincoln and Seward. Chase and Bates considered it a foolish waste of time, perhaps even a satanic diversion, while Stanton came only once to Grover's Playhouse with the sole intention of buttonholing Lincoln about some pressing matter. Seated with Lincoln in his box, Grover had been startled when Stanton arrived a half hour late, sidled up to Lincoln, and engaged him in a long conversation. Lincoln listened attentively but kept his eyes on the stage. Frustrated, Stanton grasped Mr. Lincoln by the lapel of his coat, slowly pulled him round face to face, and continued the conversation. Mr. Lincoln responded to this brusque act with all the smiling geniality that one might bestow on a similar act from a favorite child, but soon again turned his eyes to the stage. Finally, Stanton despaired utterly of conducting his business. He arose, said good night, and withdrew. According to Grover, Tad loved the theater as much as his father. John Hay noted that Tad would laugh enormously whenever he saw his father's eye twinkle, though not seeing clearly why. Often escorted to Grover's by his tutor, Tad felt at home and frequently came alone to the rehearsals, which he watched with rapt interest. He made the acquaintance of the stage attachés, who liked him and gave him complete liberty of action. Tad would help them move scenery, and on one occasion he actually appeared in a play. For the lonely boy, who broke down in tears when the appearance of Julia Taft at a White House reception recalled his happier days with Willie and the Taft boys, the camaraderie of the playhouse must have been immensely comforting.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.